Please the court. My name is Joseph Bernstein. I'm here representing Michael Smith. Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, Justice Jacobs. I want to start off by reminding the court that the central issue in Smith's trial was whether or not Smith was a participant in the robbery and the homicide and the other charges. And the question of Smith's participation, and especially with respect to the robbery-homicide, rested almost entirely on the testimony of the co-defendant, Shane DeShields. And in fact, when this court decided the direct appeal, the court noted that this was a close case until the jury decided the credibility issue. And my point here is that the credibility issue, the credibility of DeShields versus the credibility of Smith, who testified in his own defense at trial, was the key to the outcome of the trial. And we're here today to talk about essentially two errors that were made by trial counsel, and those were errors that we suggest went directly to this critical question of credibility. The first subject I want to talk about is really argument two in our brief, and that has to do with the trial court's rejection of the self-defense argument that was presented by the defense and the negative self-defense instruction. And the second issue that I want to talk about, which is a little more straightforward, is the failure by defense counsel to ask for a special instruction on the issue of the credibility of accomplice testimony, and that comes from the Bland versus State decision and some of the decisions that followed that. So I want to focus first on the what I'm going to call the self-defense issue. The trial court said self-defense doesn't apply here. And not only did the court rule that self-defense doesn't apply, the court gave a negative self-defense instruction, which essentially told the jury self-defense isn't applicable and you should not consider that. And that instruction, in so many words, told the jury just disregard whatever Smith said about what he did. And the error here is not necessarily presenting the self-defense argument, but recognizing that Smith had a federal constitutional right to present his theory of the case to the jury. Whether you label it self-defense or whatever, you don't even have to put a label on it. Under Chambers versus Mississippi and countless cases after that, and in fact, the right to present your theory of the case, the right of a defendant to present his theory of the case, is codified in the Delaware Criminal Code in Section 302, which basically says that if the defense presents evidence that negates an essential element of the offense, and in this case, Smith's testimony was, I wasn't a participant. I didn't intend for any crimes to occur, and I didn't participate in any crimes. That was the essence of his defense. He had a constitutional right to present that defense to the jury and have the jury instructed under Chambers and as codified in Section 302 that if the jury finds that that evidence, however you label it, raises a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt, you should find him not guilty. That argument was not made at the trial level. In the direct appeal,
was there an instruction along the lines of, if after considering all the evidence you have a reasonable doubt, you should find the defendant not guilty?
I don't recall. There may have been. I know there was a standard instruction, you know, list the elements of the offense. Here's what the state has to prove. If you find the state hasn't proved one of those elements, you should find them not guilty. But was there an overall general instruction? I don't recall standing here right now whether that occurred.
What does the record show is the origin of the instruction that was given? Was it requested by the state? Does the judge do this on
the negative self-defense instruction? I couldn't find where anybody requested. It was something that, quite frankly, I never understood the rationale for it. And even though this court approved it under kind of a abuse of discretion standard and basically said it wasn't an abuse of discretion to give it.
The answer is you don't know where it came from.
I don't know where it came from.
Whether it was requested by the state or
I
came,
don't believe
or
it
came
was,
full blown from the head of Zeus.
I don't believe it was requested by the state. I've never, quite frankly, encountered such an instruction, at least in Delaware, where the court's given that kind of instruction.
Ms. Bernstein, two questions. Your client did testify.
Correct.
About his theory of the case. That is, I wasn't a participant.
He gave his version of what happened.
So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay. And did his trial counsel argue that before the jury in any shape or form?
The trial counsel's argument was Smith wasn't an accomplice.
Did anyone prevent trial counsel from making an argument based on your client's theory of the case?
I would say yes, because the gist of Smith's testimony, for example, with respect to how the gun went off, that covered
well, your argument is that Smith has a constitutional right to present his theory of the case before a jury. I'm just trying to find out whether factually that he was precluded from doing that. Not as a matter of metaphysics, but factually.
Okay. I think factually he was.
How?
Well, I thought that he testified that he thought Coverdale was going to do something, and he was reacting to Coverdale's movements.
Correct.
So isn't that his theory of the case?
Well, that was his theory of the case, but when you throw the negative self-defense instruction that basically says to the jury, and the jury could have viewed that as, because Smith said, I was acting to protect myself. That's what he said.
So in response to Justice Jacobs' question, it appears your answer is he got to say what his theory of the case was. However, the instruction given by the trial judge undermined its effectiveness.
Well, it more than undermined it. It basically said you shouldn't consider it.
All right, but there are two issues we're trying to parse out. One is, did Smith get to give his theory of the case?
Right.
And the answer to that appears to be yes. And then the second, but tell me if I'm wrong on that, then the second question is, what was the legal effect of the judge's instruction?
Well, I would suggest that the legal effect of the negative self-defense instruction was to tell the jury in so many words, disregard what Smith said about what he did.
Okay, going back to Justice Jacobs' question, and you agree he got to give his theory of the case.
He did get to give his story, but if trial counsel had argued and specifically asked for a Chambers-type instruction, I would suggest to the court that if the court had given a Chambers-type instruction, the court never would have given the negative self-defense instruction.
Well, let's try to keep the logic straight. Your client got to present his story to the jury. Your position is, if I understand it, and now I'm playing off of Justice Holland's question, that the self-defense instruction undermined or destroyed the effectiveness of that story. Is that your position?
Well, yes.
Okay. So the issue, I guess, for us to decide is whether or not, as a legal matter, that instruction should be deemed to have had that effect. Is that right?
Well, I would say yes. It's a combination of the two.
Well, either we have an issue here or we don't. It's your job to frame it. Please frame it.
Well, I'm framing it in the context of the combination of not specifically asking for a Chambers-type instruction and the court giving the negative self-defense instruction.
Yeah, but
we're talking about
errors that the trial court allegedly made. I understand that one of the claimed errors is the negative instruction. Are you saying that a second related error is the failure sua sponte to give some other instruction? I mean, what are you saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that defense counsel, when the trial court said, I'm not going to let you argue self-defense, trial counsel should have stepped back and said, wait a minute. I have a right under Chambers and under Section 302B to an instruction that says, in so many words, if you believe that the evidence presented by the defendant...
Is this a failure of an effective defense by counsel? Is this an incompetence defense or a claim that you're making?
It's framed that way in the briefs.
Okay.
It's a Strickland claim.
Okay.
Well, help me understand the discussion in the brief where defense counsel didn't want the jury to know about the co-defendant's conviction, and that there was some concern that this Bland instruction would have jeopardized that. Was that a conscious decision they went through, or help me understand that?
I guess my answer to that would be, it came out in trial that DeShields committed a robbery and killed Coverdale.
Right.
Now, what is the jury going to think happened to DeShields?
So you're saying that was it really shouldn't have been a concern at all, because for all intents and purposes, the jury knew about it.
The jury knew that the person who shot Coverdale wasn't Smith, it was DeShields. Now, they may not have known what happened in DeShields' case, but that's a different question than pretending DeShields doesn't exist.
I know. But for purposes of this Strickland argument, what I'm trying to find out from you, based on the record, is whether this could be characterized as a strategic decision by trial counsel, or was it an oversight?
Well, trial counsel submitted a letter affidavit to the trial court in the Rule 61 proceeding that essentially says, in so many words, we made a mistake in not requesting a Bland-type instruction.
I understand.
That's what trial counsel said.
And that's what they said in the affidavit after the fact. But my question is there anything in the record to indicate they thought about it and decided not to ask for it at the time?
Not from defense counsel. I mean, that was an argument that's in the trial court's Rule 61 decision that I don't believe was argued by anybody.
Right. Well, that's why I'm trying to get you to clear up the record for me, because there is a suggestion in the briefs and in the trial court's opinion that this was considered and rejected in lieu of the general instruction because they didn't want the specific Bland instruction to draw attention. Isn't that what the trial judge said?
I don't think anybody ever... The trial judge never was confronted with, should we keep the jury totally in the dark about this, because nobody ever asked for a Bland instruction, so the court never had to balance the need for a Bland instruction versus any desire to keep the jury in the dark about what happened to DeShields. So those two, if they're competing, and I'm not sure that they are, interests were never in the balance because the Bland issue never came up. Nobody ever raised it.
The Chambers instruction that you would have preferred to seen given would have said what? If after considering the testimony of the defendant, you have a reasonable doubt?
I think in my brief I kind of put together an instruction that I've always seen used. It basically says the defense has, and usually you're trying to characterize what the defense is in a few words, presented evidence, as to such and such. If you find that that evidence raises a reasonable doubt as to any element of the state's case, you should find the defendant not guilty.
All right. Now,
that's the standard 302
instruction. In our last opinion, we attached as an appendix the instruction actually given by the trial judge. And after each one of the offenses charged, ultimately working its way down to the most lesser, if after considering all the evidence you find the state has established beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted in such a manner as to satisfy all the elements which I have just stated, at or about the date and place in question, you should find the defendant guilty of whatever the offense was. If you do not so find, or if you have a reasonable doubt as to any element of this offense, you must find the defendant not guilty. Now, why isn't that substantially in conformity with Chambers?
I don't think that general instruction addresses the particular concern in Chambers and Section 302.
Does it address the model instruction that you just urged?
Well, there's one in my brief that I'm going to, if I can find it rather quickly here.
All the evidence includes the defense testimony.
I'm sorry?
Doesn't all the evidence include the defendant's testimony?
Yes, it does.
Well, while you're looking, the instruction that was given here said you have to consider the credibility and people's motivation, but it left out the words from Bland about taking it with great caution. Is that the primary concern here, that there wasn't a focus on great caution?
No, I think the primary concern here is that ever since Bland, there are three decisions after Bland, I think. Cabrera, there's some discussion in some of the cases about the pattern jury instruction on accomplice testimony. There's the Boardley decision and the Solomon decision. And each time under a rationale that says we're going to give the trial court a lot of latitude in how to frame this accomplice testimony instruction, the court has approved instructions under a wide latitude standard of review that have, in so many words, watered down Bland in one way or another. Now, the trial court took this to the next logical step and said, well, we give a general credibility instruction, that's good enough.
Well, you're saying they watered it down to the point where it was diluted altogether?
Well, it right. Almost to the point of non-existence.
Okay. Is it your claim that this instruction that alluded or referred in some way to the need for some caution when we're dealing with accomplice testimony? Can I finish, please?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Is it your claim that it was plain error not for that instruction not to be given?
No, my claim is that it was a Strickland error for defense counsel not to request that a Bland instruction. It's nothing to do with plain error.
Mr. Bernstein, you have about a minute and a half.
Okay, I'm going to save my minute and a half. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Adams.
Good morning, Justice Holland. I may please the court, Abby Adams on behalf of the state of Delaware. To succeed in this appeal, Michael Smith must establish that the Superior Court abused its discretion in denying his three post-conviction claims based on ineffective assistance of counsel. The Superior Court did not abuse its discretion. The three claims all lack merit in that there was no error by counsel in any of the claims, and there's no prejudice shown with respect to any of the claims.
So the concession of error is not credible? Is that how we should handle the concession as to Bland by counsel, that they should have asked for it?
The counsel did concede that they should have asked for the instruction. Perhaps it would have been the best practice to have asked for the instruction, but he was not entitled to the instruction under Bland. Bland never said that that instruction had to be given as a matter of law. So it doesn't fall under a standard of objective reasonableness for trial counsel to have not requested that instruction.
Is that the argument, or is the argument that whether or not it did fall under an objective standard, there wasn't any prejudice?
It's both, actually, and the prejudice argument is that, you know, as the court has found since Bland, Cabrera took a little bit away from Bland, and then of course Boardley was an instruction that didn't have either of the cautions in Bland or Cabrera, that as long as the instruction was a correct statement of the law and gave the jury appropriate guidance, it's appropriate.
Well, the issue here appears to be that you know, that even though the case law has somewhat watered down the original strong instruction telling the jury that caution is required when they're considering the credibility of accomplice testimony, what happened here involved essentially any reference at all to the fact that we're dealing with a special kind of testimony that may be problematic. What is the state's position as to whether a court has discretion or not to eliminate that cautionary language from the instruction in an he said, she said, accomplished situation?
Well, the state's position is that that language wasn't totally eliminated. They did receive a general witness credibility instruction, and the same instruction, they received instructions on how to resolve conflicts in testimony. So all of that was there. The instruction that was given includes everything that was in Boardley other than three facts either otherwise came out or that the court and the parties had agreed would specifically not be told to the jury, specifically being Mr. DeShield's incarcerated status at the time. The state's position is that, and I think the state argued this in one of the prior cases, was that the instruction under Bland, I think in the prior case the state argued.
Well, let me try to clarify my question. The argument here is that this is a closed case and the conviction could very well have turned on the credibility or did turn on the credibility of the alleged accomplice, the accomplice versus the defendant. In those circumstances, the argument goes, the trial court must give some sort of cautionary instruction that highlights the potential self-interest or bias in the accomplice testimony. The question I'm asking is, if you put aside for this purpose the factual circumstance that the argued factual circumstance that neither party here really wanted an instruction that would tell the jury what happened to DeShields, should the court be giving a cautionary instruction of this kind in other cases? That is, in cases where, you know, that particular issue is not involved.
The state would say that the, or does say that the pattern instruction that was followed in Boardley is an appropriate instruction that covers all of the bases. And to be too specific with respect to commenting on a particular witness status comes close to the prohibition in Article 4, Section 19 of commenting on the facts, or instructing on the facts of the case.
Is it your position that Boardley and the general credibility instruction are synonymous, that there's no difference at all? Or is Boardley still a variation on the general instruction when it comes to accomplices?
Boardley did specifically identify the accomplice and call that person such and highlight that fact to
this
to
is
the jury.
How I understand Mr. Bernstein's argument. And Mr. Bernstein, in his brief, says there are two categories of witnesses. Witnesses that are not accomplices and accomplices. And when we're talking about the credibility of witnesses generally, we give the general instruction. But accomplices are different. And whether we use Bland or Boardley, we focus the jury's attention on an accomplice because they're different.
And under Strickland, Mr. Bernstein said, no effective attorney would ever have the jury not consider an accomplice in that special category. And therefore, in this case, where everything turned on credibility, not to single out the special status of an accomplice was really ineffective. Now, one way to approach it is to say, as my question implied, broadly in the general instruction are synonymous, but we know that's not the case. And the other is to say the general instruction was close enough, and in this case it's harmless. But the difficulty with the harmless error application is the fact that credibility was central to this whole case. So the question then becomes, under what circumstances, when an accomplice testifies and credibility is central to the case, are you still effective when you don't ask for a special instruction, whether it's boredly or bland?
To respond to the prior portion of your question, this was a credibility case. However, it wasn't just DeShields versus Smith's version of the story. There was the third person eyewitness present there who testified, and that was Mr. Blackwell. So there were two eyewitnesses who testified on behalf of the state, and then Michael Smith, obviously, the other eyewitness who testified on his own behalf. So it wasn't just the accomplice versus Mr. Smith, in this case.
So that would be part of an equation if we were going to do a harmless error analysis?
Yes.
Okay.
That goes to the fact that Mr. Smith was not prejudiced in this case. And also, on these facts, I think the instruction would have had to have been crafted slightly differently because the state, although he was charged as a principal as well, essentially sought liability against Mr. Smith as an accomplice. So that instruction would have to be recast anyway, I think, to fit the specific facts of this case without causing jury confusion. But however, here I think it is a harmless error analysis because of all the other information that came out with respect to Mr. DeShields' credibility. I think the court addressed in the direct appeal the extent to which Mr. DeShields' credibility was called into question during his testimony, and that was made very clear to the jury. And it was also made very clear to the jury about, for example, the one agreement that he had with the state with respect to staying at SCI. All of that had come out, and the jury was instructed on general credibility. And I think on these facts, it was harmless error to not have requested the additional language with suspicion of great caution or the additional identifying DeShields as the accomplice specifically because of the risk of jury confusion and the fact that Smith's bias was brought out on cross-examination and then the instruction again addresses the bias of the various witnesses.
Ms. Adams, is it the state's position that the trial court in circumstances such as the ones that we have here has discretion whether or not to give a bland or a boredly instruction? Or is there some point in which that instruction must be given? And the reason I ask that is that if the court must give an instruction that is either bland or boredly, as distinguished from the general credibility instruction, then I suppose it makes it a lot easier to argue that defense counsel was ineffective by not requesting that.
The court has never said that bland was a required instruction as a matter of law. And in Boardley, obviously, it was the instruction was much less pointed, for lack of a better way of characterizing it, than in Bland. But and even in Cabrera, the court specifically said that the trial court is given great latitude with respect to jury instructions so long as they are accurate statements of the law and adequately allow the jury to perform their function.
Okay, so the state's position based on all that is what?
Is that the trial court is not required to specifically step in and require an instruction that identifies the accomplice and...
Well, that's different than whether they have to give it upon request. And I think Justice Jacobs' question really is, if the defense counsel had said, I want an instruction that says accomplices are different. You have wide latitude to tell the jury accomplices are different, but you have to tell them accomplices are different. Wouldn't the judge have to have told the jury accomplices are different?
I'm sorry, Justice Jacobs, I did misunderstand your question. I couldn't say that in every case that they would be required to do that, but if requested, it certainly would be a stronger case for defense counsel. But on this case, in this case, it wasn't requested, and there was no error because of all the other factors that went into it. It was harmless error, if error at all, because of all the other factors.
What you're saying, we can phrase it as a hypothetical, if that makes you more comfortable. If we assume that if defense counsel had asked for an instruction that accomplices are different, however they wanted to say that, and in this case, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, defense counsel admitted they should have done that, we have a situation under Strickland where Smith has shown cause. But your argument is, even if he's shown cause, because defense counsel should have asked for an instruction and the judge probably should have given it in my hypothetical, he can't show prejudice because there was independent testimony and independent evidence beyond the accomplice testimony that would have supported the outcome.
Yes, and I apologize for phrasing it poorly, but yes, that's the state's position.
Hypothetically, if the defense counsel had asked for a bland instruction and the trial judge said, on the facts of this case, I don't like the bland instruction. We have a pattern instruction, and based upon Boardley, I'm giving the instruction that was given in this case. Would that be error by the trial judge?
Not after Boardley, no. And Justice Hahn, to address your hypothetical as well, I doubt that the trial prosecutor would have objected to a request for an instruction that this person is an accomplice and accomplices are different. That's where we are.
Ms. Adams, your argument is in response to Justice Holland's question is that even if there was error here under Strickland, it was harmless because there was another eyewitness gave testimony, and if the jury believed it, then that would basically support the conviction here. I suppose you could use that same fact to argue that that the premise of Mr. Bernstein's argument is incorrect. That is, he's saying it's a close case, it was one-on-one, and the question of who the jury believed, and your answer is, well, it wasn't so close. That there was 2-1-1, and that also was a situation that would not necessarily trigger any requirement, if any there is, to give a bland or a Boardley instruction.
I'd agree. Yes.
Is that your position?
Yes, because I mean the court obviously the testimony of the various witnesses did contradict each other, but DeShields and Blackwell were generally consistent in the overall facts, you know, that Smith had the gun, fired shots, and that sort of thing. So, yes, once you decide, but it is Smith's testimony versus basically those two witnesses, and they were all eyewitnesses.
Now, you alluded to the fact that if there had been a request for the Boardley bland type of instruction, it would have been carefully crafted, and you suggested there's some evidence in the record that they didn't want the jury to know certain things. So my question for you is the same as my question to Mr. Bernstein. Is there any basis to conclude from this record that trial counsel made a strategic decision not to ask for a Hoardley bland instruction?
I'm not aware of anything in the record that points to a strategic decision I'm not aware of trial counsel articulating the request for the instruction anywhere in the record, and I believe when they filed their affidavit, I think it doesn't speak to whether or not they considered it strategically.
My other question about the record is, do you have any insight into the origin of this negative self-defense instruction? You know, whether anyone asked for it or the judge just did it as a matter of course?
I believe that it came up in the context of the request for the self-defense instruction. I believe in the direct appeal, I don't know if it was quoted extensively, but actually it might be in the state's brief. It's quoted I think the origin of the...
The state's brief in this appeal?
In this appeal, I believe.
All right. Well, we can look at that again.
But I think essentially what happened was they were having argument on whether the self-defense instruction would come in, and I believe the trial court then determined that there was no rational basis, in fact, for the self-defense instruction to come in, and determined to instruct them on to provide the negative self-defense instruction to clarify for the jury that none of Smith's actions would have justified, none of what Smith claims to have done would have justified or been a defense to any of the state's allegations in this case. And in footnote 13 of the direct appeal, this court said that giving that instruction was not error on behalf of the trial judge. Unless the court has additional questions, the state would rely on their brief for the remainder of the argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points I want to make. First, the sample instruction that I referred to earlier is found on page 31 of the opening brief, note 27. The second point I want to make is, I take it from the questions asked of the state's attorney, that the court considers the Strickland inquiry to be cause and harmless error. That's wrong. It's prejudice. And the definition of prejudice under Strickland is far, far removed.
And we'll take judicial notice that all three of us understand Strickland is cause and prejudice.
Okay.
So if we confused you by our harmless error questions, it's not because we don't understand Strickland.
Okay. I was concerned because I didn't get that feedback when the state...
I hope I've alleviated your concern.
Okay. Then I'll sit down.
Well,
that was the only point I wanted to make.
I'd like to ask you a question.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that your complaint under Strickland regarding the issue of bland instruction is that the defense counsel did not ask for an instruction which the trial judge was not required to give?
Well, if you look at the Strickland cases where the issue was should counsel's failure to ask for that instruction, every single decision in the federal courts, at least, have come down and said that is Strickland error. It's prejudicial, where the central issue is credibility. I couldn't find a single case on the other side that said it wasn't failure to ask wasn't prejudicial in a case especially like this.
Well, let me ask it differently. If the instruction had been requested and the trial judge said, I'm not giving a bland instruction, I like the pattern instructions, and that's the instruction I'm going to give, would that have been reversible error?
Under this court's decisions after Bland, probably not, but we don't know what the trial court would have done, especially where the trial court, as I said, may very well have played it safe and given a bland instruction, a pure bland instruction.
Well, want to make sure I understand your position on whether accomplices need to be singled out as being differently. You heard my question earlier.
Yes.
So my question to you is, if defense counsel had said, I don't care how you phrase it, but I want an instruction that says accomplices are different. You can do Bland, you can do Boardley, Cabrera, any combination. And the judge had said, I am not giving an instruction that says accomplices are different for purposes of credibility assessment. Would that have been error?
Yes.
All right. So then, going back to Strickland, the cause here is that there was never a request for an instruction that said credibility assessments are different for accomplices, and the prejudice is that it wasn't given.
No, the prejudice is that if an instruction had been given in a case where credibility is essential, that establishes prejudice. Prejudice is a very low standard. If you read the Third Circuit cases, it's less than a preponderance of the evidence.
But it's predicated on the assumption that if you had asked for an instruction that accomplice credibility must be considered in a different way, you are entitled to that.
I would say yes, and under this court's decisions, there's a wide spectrum of language that could be used.
Right. Well, I misunderstood your answer to Justice Ridgely's question, because I thought you had said if the judge said, look, I'm not saying accomplices are different, I'm just giving the general instruction, that would have been all right.
No, that would not have been all right, because that would have effectively said Bland is overruled, Boardley is overruled. It would just ignore what the court has held, and I would say even if you take it as the most watered-down version you could think of, you're still telling the jury you have to consider accomplice testimony differently than the testimony of everybody else.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.